In the Second World War, and I've got a lot of pictures of this, you see these German soldiers coming out with their hands behind their head, their hands up shaking, and coming out the ward. Then you see the officers coming out, nicely dressed, with a smile. All the officers of all the officer corps of the world belong to the Masonic orders, and that Grand Hill sign must be recognized no matter what the order. When those Nazis walked out there with that Grand Hill sign with that big smile on their face, they said, those dummies got slaughtered. But we're all in the club, boys. Those little privates are shaking in the boots. Those officers had no such problem. They were in what's called the Ring Knockers Club. Anyway, what's happened here? The balance scale we keep seeing over and over again. All pagan religions are based on works. Good works outweighing bad works. What you do in this world is going to determine your eternal destiny. That the creature, by grace, through faith. Now, not of works. These religions, and here in the hand we'll always see the Ankh, the circle with the cross, the female, the male, the symbol of life, the symbol of Lucifer. You see all these male and female symbols today, and see the kids wearing the Ankhs around their necks. Ankh is a verb in the hieroglyphics. It is a verb of to live. All right? It is the verb of life. The bottom part is the male reproductive organ. The top is the female. Anyway, these works are written down, and these souls are being judged. And by the way, we should have Anubis, yeah, the jackal god. The jackal god, you see, in the Valley of the Dead has been ruled for 2,000 years by jackals, which roam around in the Valley of the Dead. It's the only thing that lives over there. All right, now we go and take a look here. This is in a Roman Catholic French newspaper, translation into English. And I'll just quote this. This is a translation in a French Catholic newspaper of a La Maison, the Masonic, French Masonic, an article in the French Masonic magazine, all right? Translated in English. You got, oh, well, anyway, it comes out somewhere. We, for traditional Freemasons, are taking the liberty to paraphrase and transposing this word from a famous statesman, which we adopt as circumstances. Catholics, Greeks, Protestants, Israelites, Muslims, Hindus, Buddhists, free thinkers, free believers are among us mere Christian names. Our family name is Freemasonry. What they're saying is all of these aren't really anything. The real religion is Freemasonry. And behind each of these things, and notice what they have interesting here. Catholics, Greeks, Protestants, Israelites, Muslims, Hindus, Buddhists, free thinkers, free believers are among us mere Christian names. That's true. Our family name is Freemasonry. That's true. Notice there's one religion missing in that list. The Christian religion. Do you notice that? They've got in there Catholics. That's not Christian. Greeks, that's not Christian. Protestants, that's not Christian. Israelites, that's not Christian. Muslims, that's not Christian. Hindus, not. Buddhists, not. Free thinkers, not. Free believers are not. They're right. All of those are the same thing. They all say that a creature by an act of will can reach divinity. As you do certain things, perform certain rites, have a certain prayer, pay certain monies, do certain good works, and your good works outweigh the bad, and you're going to go to heaven. Well, that is not what the Bible teaches, I'm afraid. Since Freemasons want all religions to have something in common, which will be considered more important than doctrine, by their doctrine we shall know. By doctrine. By every word of doctrine. These people are not interested in doctrine. This common something which will have to be experience. We're not going to give them doctrine. We'll give them experience. I know what I felt. I know I had an experience. And that is the religion based on it. An experience. not on doctrine. A direct contact with divinity. This experience will be said to be more religious and more important than doctrine. What did Paul say? If an angel comes from heaven and preach any of the gospel hear and preach, how do I know what gospel is without doctrine? Shall be accursed. How am I going to tell? But by doctrine. Here we have the sovereign imperium of mysteries, the brotherhood of the Illuminati, the order of the Illuminati, the pre-Nicene Catholic Church, the order of the True Rosy Cross, the pre-Pansophic Rite of Mizraim, the Masonry, the order of rites of Mizraim, and the charitable order of San Raphael. This is the consortium of the mystery religions headquartered in England, and the only two places I know where you get their material is in London, England, at the Frosius Lucius, that's the fraternity of Lucifer, or brotherhood of Lucifer, and their offices in the United Nations in New York. Alright? Interesting where the places are. But anyway, let me read this. These light is kind of poor here. The brotherhood of Illuminati. Maybe it's better over here. Maybe it'd be better if I got my glasses on. Can we turn off this front row of lights? We've got too much light on in here. That's our main trouble. You can't read it neither. Yeah, I can't. Somebody's gone to. There we go. You found something? There we go. Oh, boy. That helps an awful lot. Huh? The Brotherhood of Illuminati is universal in the true sense that we have no dogma, no creed, no fear, no false claims, no explanation of spiritual things, but seek to serve God and man by service. Sounds just like out of a blue book. The Birch Society, doesn't it? We make the claim that unless we serve man without the thought of creed, sect, race, or color, it is impossible to reach that state in which we would aspire, and we therefore invite all people to join us in us to work for the restoration of the true brotherhood. Remember, we're going to restore something else. Let's see how this true brotherhood, since brotherhood is a reality in nature, see how it starts out? Since brotherhood is a reality in nature, an assumption, is it true? No, it is not. False assumption will lead you to a false conclusion. What's the first thing a Mason will tell you? Oh, we're all brothers. No, we're not. I'm not his brother, spiritually or physically. I deny that. We must seek this to in the spiritual sphere and to realize the concept that we must seek to reach the spiritual reality, the Christ consciousness, the Christ reality, whether Muslim, Buddhist, Hindu, within each and every one of us. We're going to reach the Christ consciousness, whether Buddhist, Hindu, or Muslim, in each and every one of us. Now, at first, that kind of seems rather strange, doesn't it? Until you understand what they mean by Christ consciousness. That means you discovering that you are God. You are Christ. Jehovah's Witnesses are like that one. Anyway. It is your discovery of your consciousness that you are the Christ. Let me go on to show you that this is true. No matter what is called themselves, no matter what religion or name they use for the living reality of God within, it always meant the same, the finding of the ever reality of God within, the goal that all true men who love truth, brotherhood, and God, the way of at-one-ment is by the study and the living of the wisdom of the Gnosis. The inner spiritual knowledge, the underlying of religions and philosophies. What are they saying? Where are the underlying religion? We are a philosophy. Gnosis. It is a religion that we have invented by our mind. And we have by our mind discovered we are God. Yes, there's a God and we're it. Poor creatures. What abysmal gods. The Frosius Lucius, now by the way, the Frosius Lucius used to be called the Brotherhood of Lucifer. In 1923, they decided they better change the name to the Frosius Lucius, because some people kind of took that literally. Within the Frosius Lucius, you will be taken along the path, this path in five stages, which correspond to the Gnostic system of illumination, to that of the birth of the Christ within the human heart. You will then receive the first initiation, which will tend to open the doors of the soul to the influence of the Christ. Well, your first initiation is to open the doors to the influence of the Christ. Who is this Christ? Is this the person, Jesus of Nazareth, sitting at the right hand of the Father? He crucified, dead, buried, and resurrected in the flesh on the third day, sitting at the right hand of the Father bodily? No, this is something entirely different. In the next initiation, but notice how they use the words. Notice the words you see that are used. Sound almost Christian, don't they? And the next initiation is that of baptism. Here we assist you to open the way between the astral and mental regions of being. The lower mind is then flooded with some, boy, we really have, oh, popped out, lost that one. Okay, flooded with the higher mind, and then it goes on. Oh boy, I'm going to have to find that one. I don't know where it dropped out. The other half of that. I'm sorry. Here's all that's left of the first Mormon temple in the way for Illinois. The sunburst and the great fields. All right, there's old Baal coming up. Poor Joseph Smith. You know, this guy, he only had third grade education, and they gave him this novel, and which was written in 1817. I think they really recopied it, put in the Bible verses, and came up with the Book of Mormon and handed them the whole thing. And this guy goes out to part and press this religion. Now, a few things that are interesting about this Mormon religion, so-called, is that you can't get a good religion going without a martyr. So Joseph Smith gets out here to Illinois, and he and his brother Hiram, they get himself arrested by all the Masons and thrown into jail. But they are both worshipful masters. Scott is right. Joseph was worshipful master. Hiram was a member of the Scottish Rite Lodge. And they weren't worried at all because, after all, these guys are going to come to lynch them. Happened to be all good Masons. And when they came, they gave the grant. By the way, the Masons smuggled in some pistols to them. Isn't that nice? So that when they came out there, the mob came. These guys are sitting there smiling, giving the grand hail sign, both physically and verbally. Oh, Lord, my God, is there no help for the widow's son? Which every Mason must come to their aid. And while these guys are giving that, oh, Lord, my God, is there no help for the widow's son? They blew them in. And they said, well, they had guns and they were shooting. They smuggled the guns to them, then went down and blew the guys in. You see? Well, now you had martyrs. Now, Joseph Smith, according to Masonry, cannot be wrong in any prophecy because he was an apostle, infallible. Yet Joseph Smith says that he was taken in a vision to the moon and met the people in the moon who were almost all universally 6 feet tall and dressed as Quakers. That's in the Mormons' own newspapers and their own books. They haven't reprinted that since 1937. They dropped it out, but it still happens to be there. Now, according to the Mormon Church, the president of the Mormon Church at his inauguration said, if Joseph Smith in his prophecy was wrong in any part, Mormonism is a gigantic hoax. Well, he said it. And we can go, for example, there's a few interesting things about this Joseph Smith. Joseph Smith, of course, was a bigamist way before he got the revelation from God about bigamy. He got the revelation after he was a bigamist, not before. His second wife is an interesting person. Joseph Smith, or there was a man named Captain William Morgan. Captain Morgan, and this little book here is his little book, was a Mason, and he decided if Masonry was moral and good as he was told it was, then there was no harm in publishing the ritual. And if it was evil, then it was necessary to publish the ritual. So he did. He and another Mason named Miller, who published it, and William Morgan wrote it, 1826. Well, the Lodge took both these men into custody at the Grand Encampment of New York with the governor, the senators, and the representatives of the state all present as they had a trial. And they decided on death. Then at Niagara, Fort Niagara, where they had incarcerated these two men, and Miller escaped. Morgan didn't. They had a group, I believe, of six who drew lots for the actual execution. Three of them took him out in a rowboat out to Niagara River, bound him up with chains, and shoved him over into the icy waters. About a year later, his body washed up on the shore in 1827, and a scandal broke loose nationwide, as which the nation has hardly ever heard one since. And the scandal was so bad over this murder, and the fact that all of these people were involved, not one was ever indicted or brought to trial. That would be interesting, wouldn't it, huh? Where were they going to find a judge? But the newspapers, the politicians of this country had to take a position, pro or anti-Mason. The churches took positions of pro or anti-Mason. And many of the churches who have anti-Mason clauses in them stem from this time. The state of New Jersey outlawed any Mason from holding public office, since it would be criminal for them to do so, since they've already broken any oath of office before they have arrived. And things of this happened. The anti-Mason party was formed, and it almost won office when they found out that the leader of it, their candidate, happened to be a secret Mason. But the Masonic Party finally did elect the president, the Anti-Masonic Party, in 1860. Didn't know that one, huh? The Republican Party is the Anti-Mason Party. It was renamed in 1856. All right? And every member of the cabinet was a Mason but two, Seward and Lincoln. And the night Lincoln was shot, Seward was stabbed on the other side of town. That wasn't a lone assassin, was it? His throat was cut. Seward was Secretary of State. Yeah, the Masons had a little job doing it. And by the way, the Secretary of War admitted his part in it. And Grant knew about it. He got out of town. All the boys were in on that show. Anyway. Oh, I get to the point about this Captain William Morgan. Captain William Morgan was a married man, and know who his wife married after he died? Joseph Smith. The second wife of Joseph Smith is Captain William Morgan's wife. Isn't that a nice coincidence? Well, anyway. Here we find, I at the time went down to an encampment of the Klan on, what's the name of that mountain there? Stone Mountain, Georgia, right outside of Atlanta. There's a mountain there with all of the boys, you know, Jeff Davis and Robert E. Lee and all Stonewall and all those good guys. And I decided, maybe have you ever seen that? They kind of went wild with the jackhammer and, they got this thing half done, and they realized that the guy had blown the whole thing, and that big rock is sitting there unfinished, and they don't know what to do with it. All the horses are smaller than the guys. The horses are big dog size, and the whole thing is just big guys sitting on these itty-bitty horses, and all in a great big piece of stone sitting there like a big sore thumb. Anyway, you can see for miles. Now, on top of that mountain was the founding of the Klan and the Ku Klux Klan. But the Ku Klux Klan was not founded then. In 1860, let me put it this way, every member of the Union cabinet, but Seward and Lincoln, were a member of the Ku Klux Klan. And every member of the Southern cabinet, including the president of the Confederacy, were all members of the Klan. The Klan then had a different name. It's called the Knights of the Golden Circle. But Golden Circle in Greek is Ku Klux. After the war, the Golden Circle, which is what wiped out Lincoln and ran this little show, had a name change in 1868. The Knights of the Golden Circle, which was operated by England under the crown, but from England, it was headquartered there, disbanded. And immediately that day, the Ku Klux Klan was formed. The Klan is a lodge. Anyway, here's a little book I have over here, a very interesting one. This is a book by a man named Ronayne. Ronayne was a member, a worshipful master of Scottish Rite Lodge, raised a Catholic, and then converted to the gospel. And he writes a book which is very interesting, the title of it. It says, containing a thorough explanation of the signs, the cryptic passwords, so forth of the Freemasons. And I'm trying to think of the part on the front cover. Comparing Masonry, Catholicism, the mystery religions, and comparing them all with the Bible. And he wrote that this is a very fascinating work. And let's kind of conclude this portion of the session with this interesting little cartoon from the Lord Fernandy. With all his mines and oil wells in the Orient, Daddy's been out there hundreds of times. But he says one time he traveled to the East but didn't make a dime meant more to him than all the other trips he'll ever make. I don't get it, do you? And there's old Sandy giving a big wink. You see, when you go into the lodge, you have no money in your pocket. You have nothing to buy with. You come in either shod or unshod, half clothed, half one shoe on, one shoe off, the whole thing. See? That's when he traveled to the East. And he made more then than he ever made with all his oil wells and mines. A note is this, that conspiracy is as natural with natural man as breathing. The thing of people sitting in the company deciding, oh, look, if we do this and we do that and we're going to get this, this is done all the time. The only difference with these conspirators is that they are better organized, that they have put on ruthless penalties, that they will extract those penalties. That keeps the troops in line. They pay off to those people who go along and play their game by giving them nice little inside tips in the market, nice little helping hands. You play the game, you go down to City Hall, and your plans when you got that ring get stamped out. Bing, bing. Yes, brother. And you go in the army, and you find that you get the promotion if you got the ring. You go down, and you find doors kind of open. That all sorts of kind of nice things happen to you. Why, of course. You just didn't join this thing to join any evil conspiracy. You joined it to sell insurance. That's why most people get... you never found an insurance salesman, huh? He didn't go and join a church. He's looking for customers. Now, those of you who are insurance salesmen, I just take that as a... Well, yes, I am. Okay. Now, but what happens is this. You start receiving favors from these people, and they will call for the day in which you are to pay the price for them. There's nothing free under the sun. Earth has its worth for the price Earth gives us. The beggar's tax for the corner he lies in. The priest has his fee who comes here and shrives us. We bargain for the fields we die in. The devil's booth, all things are sold. It sounds of dross, it sounds of gold. Bubbles we buy with the whole soul's tasking. Only God that may be had for the asking. You see what it is in this world. Here's a young fellow. He's coming along. Nice, bright young fellow. Here's a nice member of the Illuminati. Third degree. Shriner. Respectable citizen. Takes this young fellow under his wing. I have a fellow telling us one day, and here's a guy out front. He goes, that's me. You know, just that happened. He says, now here, takes him down. Says, join the lodge. Everything's taken care of. I take care of it. And then he says to this nice young man, say, of course, this guy's driving his Rolls, got his big cruisers, lives in his big house, makes money. One day he says to him, he says, hey, Bill, I like you. I'll tell you what. Have you gained money? Well, I got a couple thousand put away. Put on Ajax Mining, 4 o'clock next Wednesday. Hold it to Friday at 3 o'clock. Oh, I don't know about that. If you lose a penny, I'll make it up to you. You won't lose a penny. This guy goes down all trembling. He goes down, he puts his money on the sink, and it triples in 2 days. That's the way it's done. He goes back. Oh boy, he wants to hang around this fella. He's kind of saw something. And the guy says, Columbia medals. 11:30 Tuesday. Be out Wednesday. 2:15. Happens right on the money. These markets aren't a market. They're a rigged show. There are people who know. How do they know? They can make a market. When you're big enough, you don't have a market. You are the market. All right? They don't guess. You know, it's like W.C. Fields back there in My Little Chickadee. He's sitting there, and he's got these cards, and this guy, he goes zip with the cards, zip with the cards. They're on there getting ready to play a little AC/DC, and this fellow says, is this the game of chance? And W.C. Fields says, not the way I plan, boy. Not the way I plan. There's no game of chance at all. Hey, we don't want any gambling going on, right? This is just called fleecing the sucker. Well, anyway, pretty soon this guy sits there one night and he's got to figure it out. There are people who know, and there are people who really know. And those who really know aren't lucky. They're smart. They're on the right side, on the inside pipeline of whatever it is that makes this thing tick. These guys know. This guy becomes the lackey, the trainee, the extra ego extension of this older man with this young, bright fellow. And he just pays this guy, and this guy is starting to clack down. 2,000, 3,000, 5,000 a week. You know, he's not doing bad. And he starts buying nice cars, nice boat, nice home, big mortgages. Living, he is a successful man. But his job pays $250 a week. But his bills now at $4,000 a week. Now you see, he can't alienate this friend of his. If he ever gets out of line, if he ever doesn't do as he's told, if he ever squirms, if his conscience ever bothers him of anything he's ever told to do or be or follow, this fellow just has nothing to do with him. And he finds out he's got mortgages and payments he can't make. He can't breathe. This guy didn't do anything to him, you see. It's like heroin. Once on that hook, you're on it. See? Here's this guy, this friend of mine. This guy got converted to the gospel. He went in and told his masons off. He told off this multimillionaire. In 4 or 5 months, and the wife in their hard times, they couldn't pay their bills, and she's on him, that broke this guy down into nothing. And now he's nothing but a crawling, sniveling worm, trying to crawl back in, and he can't get in. They won't let him in. And he's all, in the worst, the most miserable world. Miserable with himself. He's desperate. He's desperate. He's in a physical, terrible condition. You wouldn't believe it. You want to play in the game? There's no such thing as a legitimate free market in this country. They don't exist. The pros, the insiders, they win. The amateurs, the outsiders, they lose. They're there for the milking. How do you think the insiders win? By milking the outsiders. You can't win by milking each other. All right, now let's go and take a look at a little economics. I said I would get into for a bit, and it's such a big subject, and for the period of time we have now, we can't go into a lot of it, but I just thought we'd get a little background. Let me take you through a little whiz, a little history of banking. Just a real quickie. We mentioned the Rothschilds. Let's take a look at the United States, the history of money in this country. As I said, the Constitution of the United States was a very unusual document. Unusual mostly because of the absence of a central banking financing organization for milking the people. The key of milking the people is a phony money system in which we can create that money out of nothing and milk them off by going in debt, creating a big interest charge, and forcing them to pay taxes to pay to us legitimately under an interest expense. Now watch what happened. In 1789, the people would not buy, nor the Continental Congress, the concept of a central bank. Oh, it was proposed. Hamilton and the boys tried all they could to get paper money in a central bank. But they were voted down. Why were they voted down? Because they knew, the Continental Congress, that if they passed and put in the central bank, the Constitution would not pass. The people would vote it down. Why would they vote it down? Because they had just had the Articles of Confederation and a central bank that had printed paper money, and inflation had zoomed up and all of them were so destroyed, and as Washington said, there was rioting in the streets, the people were taking up guns and going in and holding up their legislature, there was no law and order, business had ceased, poverty and unemployment were everywhere, the nation was in total chaos and civil disorder. And they passed the Constitution, which prohibited a central bank and required hard money, and in 6 months, Washington is writing to his friend, "You cannot believe that it is the same country. Peace and prosperity everywhere. Employment high, unemployment low, prices stable, trade increasing." The whole nation had been converted in 6 months from total economic chaos to a stable, prosperous economy by outlawing phony money and a central bank. 2 years later, Hamilton and the boys, the British central money boys, the paper money fellows, succeeded in pressing through in 1791 the first U.S. Banking Act, which established the United States Bank for 20 years, because that was the limit of how long a money bill could be. 20 years. And we had the first United States Bank, and that charter expired in 1811. And Congress did not renew as ordered. And immediately we were in war. And when the war was over, one of the conditions appears to be that we would have a second banking act, which we did that year, 1816, the second banking act. We were given our orders and Congress marched to the tune. That second banking act, which set up the second Bank of the United States, lasted until 1836, when again it came up for renewal, and it passed Congress and went to the president, who was a member of the lodge, and was inside the club, and was supposed to be a guaranteed signature, and he vetoed it. And Andrew Jackson has been maligned ever since. Andrew Jackson refused to extend the central bank. Immediately after the refusal, the United States was to be punished. The banks in New York particularly withdrew their money from the United States out of the banking system, and we had the bank panic of 1837. In the middle of that panic, a man named August Belmont arrives from Germany, from the Rothschild Bank headquarters on the Main, and with the money he now finances the crushed banks, and they joined his system, and he set up a de facto Federal Reserve system, in which was now Rothschild owned, but it was not legally sanctioned. We now needed a war, and that war was arranged as in 1850, Bismarck says in his diary that he was at a wedding of the Rothschilds while it was to be in the war with in the United Civil War in the United States was being discussed. This is 1850. That it had been decided upon. And he's writing this in his memoirs in 1850. That the Civil War in the United States had been decided upon. the necessity was to bring in a central bank in the United States because, you see, with the fall of Napoleon, all of Europe had a central bank except one country, major country, Russia. And the only other major country in the world without a central bank under Rothschild control was the United States of America. But with August Belmont, they had in effect done this, but they wanted to make it legal. They wanted to have it so that it was now had the sanction of government behind their debt. And so, with the Civil War, we now have the passage of the Banking Act, and now which outlawed basically the state banks and the private banks and put them under federal control and charter. And we had, of course, the massive loans with England, and we had the plan, of course, was for the Union to lose. France was ready for their invasion across the Rio Grande, as they had taken Mexico under, what was his name there? Maximilian. The English were moving troops into Canada for invasion across at Detroit and across at Niagara, while the South had moved from the, the advance in the South, and in the West, the rebellion had already been started for the breakaway of the West to form a separate nation. It was a big movement, you see, in the 1860s for sovereign separate nationhood for the Western states west of the Rockies. And you see, Lincoln was here with a cabinet made of enemies, the South on one side, England on the North, with the most powerful fleet in the world to blockade his harbors, and France ready to come across in Rio Grande, and the West rebelling. The situation looked desperate. He now took desperate action. One, the people of England were strongly against slavery. They had outlawed slavery in 1837. And the people of England were strongly anti-slavery. Lincoln knew this. Lincoln did not care, or was not important to him, of freeing or not freeing the slaves. He said if the Union is preserved with them free, he'd free them. And if not freeing them would preserve the Union, he wouldn't free them. The freeing of the slaves was not the issue. The issue was the preserving of the Union. Now, Lincoln, in his desperation, did some very desperate acts. One, he had our secretary or our foreign ambassador to England declare war on England. Most people don't realize this. Declared war on England because England had been building warships for the South, and two warships were in the ways in which, if launched, could break the blockade without even English intervention. These warships each mounted two rotating turrets, fore and aft, with rotating 12-inch guns, and there was nothing in the Union could stand against that kind of a bombardment. And the war was to be declared the moment either ship touched the water. On the day of the launching of that ship, the people of England, of course, I think Lincoln had his agents out there stirring them up, but he had mass marches before the Parliament, mass demonstrations, and at the last minute, the Parliament ordered the launching stopped. It was that close down to hours. But the reason why the English crown pulled off of the war is that the only other nation without a central bank lent their entire fleet to Abraham Lincoln. Russia sent the Baltic Fleet into New York Harbor. Now, the Baltic Fleet operating in a short range against the British fleet operating at 2,000-mile range gave Lincoln military superiority, naval superiority on the East Coast. The Tsar of Russia sent the Pacific Imperial Fleet into San Francisco to put down the rebellion. Lincoln had nothing to reserves to send us to the West. And those two fleets stayed in New York and in San Francisco for the rest of the war. And the Tsar put them under Lincoln's command. Now, the Tsar was known as the Great Emancipator. He freed the serfs in Russia. And they blew the Tsar up. Wham! They blew him up, and they shot Lincoln. They got them both, didn't they? Anyway, you know, I was standing on the bridge in the Peter Paul Fortress in Leningrad a couple years ago, in a snowstorm. And we had this girl who was a guide, very bright girl, real sharp gal. We're going through the Hermitage and so forth, and her knowledge was just really quite a secret. And the people had walked ahead. She, of course, walked along behind to see that everybody had getting on into where they were supposed to be. And I lingered back, and I came up behind her, and I says, "Tasha, I'd like to talk to you about Russia and Lenin." I said, "Do you realize that in three wars, the United States and Russia have been allies? In the American Civil War, it was Russia that came to the aid of the Union. In 1917, we were allies, and we were allies in the Second World War. And yet your government tells you that we're enemies. And my government tells me that we're enemies." And she says, "If we talk, we die. If we talk, we die." I said, "I didn't tell you to talk. You just stand there and look out over the river. You're not going to do any talking. I'll do the talking." And I was explaining to her the millions that Lenin received. And I was explaining that what happened, you see, in this the Civil War. And notice that the Emancipator Tsar and the Emancipator President were both blown in because they didn't have a central bank and they both got one. I said, "You know, we both have the same enemy." And finally she's sitting there and she says, "If I escape to America, I starve to death. I starve if I'm in America." I said, "Oh, I don't really think so." You know, the guy like Cal was obviously very sharp and bright and very knowledgeable, cultured person. I said, "No, I don't think so." But anyway, when I left that hotel, I was coming down to the lobby, and you could see her around the corner. She was waiting, you know. And we got talking again. And we got around this corner. These people live in fear. But anyway, the central bank was partially established. And what was established was the one thing they had not been able to do since 1789. They got a paper money. A paper money. At first, you back the paper money, it runs very good. Then, at first, it's United States paper, U.S. debt. And, of course, we're not paying interest on it. The government printed it. There's no interest, right? No debt has been created. They just created this paper money. It's non-interest-bearing notes is what it is, isn't it? So the government doesn't run any deficits. There is no extra taxes. But by 1913, they start a new thing. A private company called the Federal Reserve Bank, which is not owned by the government, nor is it an agency of the government, now is allowed to print paper notes. And they lend these paper notes to the government, and the government pays them interest on the paper they created out of nothing. And from then on, we pay to the secret owners of the Federal Reserve Bank, and they are secret. There are three classes of stock authorized in the Federal Reserve Act, Class A, B, and C. One class was to be purchased by the banks. Half of that issue was sold to the banks. The banks have never bought the other half, the member banks. The second class was available to be purchased by the United States government. The U.S. government has never done so. It could, but it hasn't. So the bank is totally private. That is, the government, if it wanted to exercise it, could become one third partner in it. But it hasn't. The third class was available to be sold to private citizens. But it was never publicly offered to private citizens. Has it ever been sold to private citizens? We don't know. The Federal Reserve Bank has never been audited and refuses to be so. They refuse to declare who are the owners. Now we have this nice little monopoly set up by the government, owned privately by secret owners, who have a right given by the government, an exclusive right to print paper called money, unbacked, unredeemable, with no maturity date, no payer, and no payee. Remember, a note has to have five conditions to be a note. A sum certain, redeemable, at a place certain, by a person certain, to a person certain. See, there has to be a sum certain, a time certain, a place certain, from a person certain to a person certain. The five conditions of a note. Notice, the Federal Reserve note promises to pay nobody anything at any time or any place by anybody. Every condition of a lawful note is missing. And if one is missing, it's not a lawful note. There isn't one condition there. What is it? It's a piece of paper unbacked, unredeemed, that is lent to the United States government. In return, the United States government gives them a bond which we pay taxes on to pay the interest forever on the money supply created out of nothing. Do you know how profitable that is? When you create $800 billion worth of debt out of nothing and collect interest at the 10%, let us say, that's $80 billion a year, or 80,000 millions a year. That's enough to make 80,000 people a millionaire every year. Do you know you can get rich on a game like that? Even if you had 80,000 stockholders that each get $1 million a year, that's not bad gold. One of the biggest scams, they talk about app scam. What? Small potatoes, 25,000, 50,000. Man, we can afford those all day long. What are we going to do about the $1 billion ripoff per day? You're paying that tax. And that money now is legally transferred from you to private pockets through the guise of interest on a debt that was created out of nothing. They put up nothing and lent nothing. They allowed the government to use their pieces of paper, which are unbacked and irredeemable. It is so absolutely fantastic, you can't believe it. You know it's true. It's there in the books. You can see it, and it's still unbelievable. I explain it to you, and it's unbelievable to you and to me. I can't even grasp it. You know why? The numbers are too big. My brain went blink out there just like yours did. Do you know what one little billion is? One little billion? And our government spends those in half a day. If you had $1 billion the day Christ was born and spent $1,000 every day, you still got 800 years to get rid of your first $1 billion. And they have a little $2 billion or $4 billion project of this, a little uplifting thing about a couple billion here and a few billion there. All of the purpose of those things is not to uplift the downtrodden, but to create more debt, to transfer more interest from the public to the central committee of the elite corps. All lawful, all on the books, all done by contract, all under nice due payable bonds. Why didn't the government just print the money themselves? I mean, the Federal Reserve can print it out of nothing. Why couldn't the government print it themselves? Why can't the Treasury do it? That's what it used to do. Well, if the Treasury did it, then there would be no bonds and no debt. There'd be no interest payments to the private hands. The government could easily print their own money and save all the interest. But the government is not controlled by you or me, but by the people in the Federal Reserve. The government is their agency. The amount of money we're talking about, presidents cost 8 to 10 million. They're cheap. You know, it only takes about $200,000 to buy a senator or a congressman. What does it cost when we're talking about $80 billion a year? What percentage does it take for the expenses of buying a Congress? We have the best Congress money can buy. Is that strange or unusual to you? Are you surprised? There's too much in there to leave those things in the hands of you plebeians, you proletariat. You were to think that going down to that little booth and pulling a little lever, that you're determining the affairs and the economy and the prosperity and the future of this country. If you're that naive, there's no hope for you. You don't vote for anybody. I was telling 2 or 3 years ago, Reagan was going to be the next president. Why? Because Time magazine was giving him fair coverage. That tells me, Reagan's the boy. If he hadn't been picked, he would never got coverage. All they have to do is make sure he doesn't win, is give him no coverage. All of a sudden, all the media is giving reasonable coverage to this fella. Hey, Ben Chosen. He's in. Here, let's take a look in the election before. You could tell a year before Carter was the man. How could you tell? Time magazine put him on the cover 5 times. And the first time they put him on, they made him look just like John Kennedy. You thought it was John Kennedy on there. The guy who drew up the picture made it look so much like John Kennedy, you had to read over and over, and it said Jimmy Carter. Nobody knew who he was, but he looked like John Kennedy. Every other person got on once. Carter got on five times. That's it. You want to know what's going to be? Read Time. It's the news magazine to read. Not to find out what's happened, but what's going to happen. They don't make mistakes. Remember? Somebody's got the pipeline. If something happens, remember? We planned it that way. Franklin Delano Roosevelt thought he was pretty high, but he wasn't. He really was a third echelon doorkeeper in the club. But they allow you once in a while to come around and they'll give you a little bit of time. What else are you going to do? He's crippled. There's nothing much to do under the sun. Let's go back and look at the money. The 1920s. 1925, 26, 27, the Federal Reserve started their first real money game. Up until this, they'd been playing it kind of cautious. They hadn't really got the feel of this. Now they had 10 years of experience, and people were used to seeing this funny stuff. So now they decided to play the round one of the melt game. What they did is start to bid up the stocks. And they bid these stocks up, and up they were going. You know what happens? I've watched this in silver. I've watched it in gold. I've watched this game played over and over and over again. And when I see the game is really going to be played, I get on right a little myself, you know? No use not making a few bucks when you can obviously see it's coming. But anyway, I've never lost. I've always won. Because I understand the market doesn't move. It moves when the plan is. It's all been predetermined. If you can figure the plan, then you can ride with them. You don't ride against them, you ride with them. Anyway, all of a sudden these guys are all starting to bid up the stocks. You start out bidding the stocks up a little, you know, buying up, buy up margin, up limit, up limit, up limit for a few days. Pretty soon the little guys are sitting there watching, hey, look at that, taking off. And they go and buy a little. Let's try a little try. And they get in it and they start making easy money. And pretty soon they're doubling up, 10% down, margin for the 90, right? Doubling up, and they're getting bigger and bigger holds. But look, they're making millions. Every time that moves up, their margin 10%, with a 10% rise, they double their money. If you haven't figured that out, just play it a little while. You'll find out the opposite happens when it comes down. Dropping 10% wipes out 100% of your money. It's great on the upswing, and it's disaster on the down. But for 4 years, it kept going up and up and up, and everybody's talking, and all the advisors and all the experts is going forever, that there's no end, there is no horizon, there is going forever. See? In March 1929, there's a little meeting in New York. After that meeting, Bernard Baruch sells out, the Rockefellers sell out, the Kennedys sell out, all of the big bankers sell out. The big people were out by August. Then the Federal Reserve cut the money supply, reduced the money supply, 4 times in a month. What 4 drastic reductions of the money supply. Then one day in October, all of the banks called all of their loans on all their margins at the same minute. Every bank on the money desk, and these were call loans, callable on demand. All these people had their stock out there on margin, borrowing 90%, had a payoff now. Well, they went to the banks, and the banks weren't lending. They were calling. They run to the market, and everybody's trying to sell. Who can buy? The banks had shut the money off. The call desks were closed. The money desk shut down. Bam! They shut all the money on the money desk. And all these people are running around trying to sell because they had to sell 10% down and they were wiped out. All of the people who weren't on the inside were gone. Now, let's take a look. Bernard Baruch, that great advisor to the presidents, right? Bernard Baruch, in 1914, financed the campaign for the first time and only twice he ever financed a political campaign. He financed Woodrow Wilson for the presidency. Woodrow Wilson, he kept us out of war, made Bernard Baruch head of war production. Bernard Baruch put $11,000 million in contracts through his own company, keeping us out of that war. $11,000 million. He paid one and a half for the president. Now that's, billion, $11,000 million, $11 billion, $11,000 million. He paid $1.5 million for the campaign. That's a good return. You figure out what the markup is on that. Hey, you could become a rich man. Bernard Baruch in 1932, after the crash took place, you see, that was just the first crash. Crash number two. Franklin Delano Roosevelt ran for the presidency. And after he was elected and before he took office, Bernard Baruch told the son-in-law, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, that he had bought 5/16 of all the world's silver. And he bought it for 10% down. That's 1/3 of all the silver in the world. That's a lot of silver. And Curtis Dahl was amazed. Why silver? He said, you'll see. The first act of President Roosevelt, as he took office, was to double the price of silver to help out Western miners. Do you know what Bernard Baruch made? 500% markup and 1/3 of the world's silver. You know, you could get rich. That little presidency only cost him $2.5 million. Hey, you see the name of the game? This is great stuff. Now, Bernard Baruch and the boys now pulled another one. They had old Franklin in the White House there. And Franklin every day started moving the price of gold up and down, up and down, up and down, up and down, to where nobody knew where it was going to be. Since all contracts that were made were payable in gold, were still under gold contracts and gold obligations, nobody could lend in 1933 for a simple reason. They didn't know what they were going to get paid back in. So all lenders had to say, wait a minute, we're going to stop until the gold price settles down. But it didn't settle down. Roosevelt moved it every day, up or down. He got in the morning, he said, oh, let's make it $26. Let's make it 23 today. Let's make it 29 today. Oh, I feel like a good drop this morning. He just made it up at breakfast and popped a new number, and that was it. The chaos in the money market was so bad that all the money dried up. Then he goes on the radio and says, the bankers won't lend. The finances have been dried up. We now have to have a national emergency, and declares a bank holiday. Uh-huh. Now, before he did that, he pulled another little game. This was even slicker. He asked the American people, because of the crisis and emergency, to come and lend the government their gold on his receipt and promise to return them their gold in 90 days and give them their gold back. Do you know the American sucker is so patriotic and so loyal that they ran down and turned in 90% of the private held gold in the United States and took that president's promise to give it back to them in 90 days. They still hold the promises. They never got it back. Because before the 90 days is over, they passed a law making it illegal for them to ask for it back. Pardon? Paper dollars. They couldn't get their gold back. Do you think they would have turned their gold in if they had outlawed it first and then said turn it in? They would have never seen any of it. They tricked the American people into turning in their gold. Now, once they got tricked into turning in their gold, now they pulled another little game. They bought that gold at 19 an ounce. The banks did. And then the president raised the price to $35 an ounce, and they now sold it back across the street into the Federal Reserve out of the banks of Chase Manhattan at a nice little markup of $19 to $35 in a day. Hey, you know, you can get rich playing those games. Now that they had made themselves a nice 500-600% profit on that game, and they had the market now beaten down to 5% on the market,
For every person who sold a share of stock in the Depression, somebody bought it very cheap. Those who didn't have paper money and couldn't create all this stuff didn't buy. The people who had now the monopoly of creating money out of nothing could buy all of it. They bought America's wealth. For everybody who lost in that Depression, they said everybody lost in the Depression. No, for everybody who lost a dollar, somebody made one. For everybody who lost, somebody gained. Everything got transferred from somebody to somebody. It's like in a poker game. You ever, in the old days, I used to play poker. I haven't played poker in 30 years anyway. But I noticed one thing about a poker game. You go there and play poker all night, and everybody went out a loser. I'm down 15 bucks. I dropped another 10. I must be 35 down. There's no winners at a poker game. I'm going to tell you, somebody won. He's not talking. Somebody's been slipping the money off that table in their pocket all night. Somebody's been constantly cashing chips. Right? Yes, for everybody who lost, somebody gained. Do you think the money isn't made? No. Look, where's money? In every catastrophe, money's to be made for those people who understand that catastrophe and are on the right side of it. There is no bad times that there isn't great money to be made. You see, you can make as much in a falling market by going short as you can make in a rising market by going long. In fact, more. The one thing you need to do this is you must have fluctuation. The more waves, the bigger the waves, if you know where they are, the bigger you make. So now the Federal Reserve, you see, at first, what had they done? They made paper money, but they backed it with gold. It was treasury. Then we have Federal Reserve money, but it was backed by gold and fully redeemable. Well, people got used to that. That looks good, doesn't it, huh? I can go down and get my gold anytime I want it. Then they decide after a while, when you get used to paper, we don't need to keep really the gold. We'll keep half the gold. We can now reach twice as much of this. And then four times, 25% reserves. 1968, they said, let's quit the hoax. We haven't got 25%. There isn't anything. We abandon any even pretense of even having any. The papers say payable on demand. Pretty soon that line just disappears. It just says $20. It doesn't say anything else. $20 what? 20 in what? What is this as a note? A note is redeemable. It's something. A note is a call on something else. A call on what? Well, on services and labor. Who is services and labor? The guy who issued it? He's not going to give any services and labor. They printed it back, the redeemable, on nothing. Now, I'll give you one example. Talk about economics. Let's go back to France. And after the French Revolution of 1789, all these good liberals and uplifters of the downtrodden decided to build the perfect communist utopia. And so what they did is have all their wonderful projects, and they plunged right into them, all of their dream schemes of solving the world's problems. But it took money. So what they did is they went out and seized the Catholic Church lands, which was quite a considerable amount of lands in France. And once they had seized these lands, they issued paper money secured by the church lands as collateral. Well, the stuff turned out to be pretty good. Well, it was so good. And, of course, the government soon spent it all up. This paper money, well, it worked last time. They issued a second issue on the same land. You know what happened? Prices rose. For some reason, the Francisines fell on the market. Well, when the prices rose, it took more of this paper money to do their wonderful schemes. So they issued a third issue, and a fourth issue, and a fifth issue, and a sixth issue, and a seventh issue, and the government really started printing all this nice good stuff, just as good as paper as before, backed by those nice good lands. The only trouble is there was more and more pieces of paper against the same lands. And prices went on, just started going up. So what they did is say, prices really haven't risen up 800%, but only 300%. It is 3 cents to the gold louis, the gold coin of the monarchy. In order to make this thing appear to be so, because this is the way socialists always believe, they believe their God, and if they declare it to be so, it must be so, they pass the law.
they passed a law to say this is good money. And if they pass a law that says it's good money, you got to take it. It's got to be good money. We are the law. And who? How could we be wrong? We did it in our wisdom, didn't we? Isn't that the argument? Well, their wisdom did. The French people didn't quite understand that. So when they would say the price is 3-1 to the Louis, well, the prices when you wanted to go buy a Louis was 15-1. Well, that was an embarrassment. So the government did the natural thing. They outlawed the gold Louis. Obviously. They made it illegal to have them. If you didn't have them, you wouldn't know how much the inflation took by it, would you? And therefore, you could actually believe in the faith, and all we need is faith in these pieces of paper. If everybody believed they're good, aren't they? It's only a matter of faith. No, it is. It's a matter of quantity. If you increase the quantity, the price falls. The price of money falls in the market because the quantity is increased. Simple, like anything else. You dump 3 times as many potatoes on the market, the price of potatoes fall. You dump 3 times as much paper money on the market, the price of paper money falls. It's called inflation. You know, you could figure that out if you hadn't been to school. So what happens? They outlawed the Louis, but that didn't help. Because they would say it's now 10-1. But every Frenchman knew the real price because he could stop at any doorway in Paris and say, how much is a Louis? 287 today. The government said 10. The market said 287. The people didn't believe the government. They believed the market because the price is what it takes to get one. The government had 10-1, but they wouldn't give you any. Our government for years said gold is $35 an ounce, but you can't have it. Well, that's no price. The question is, what does it take for me to get it? That's the price, isn't it? The price isn't something written on a board. It's the what it takes to get one. Just like there was under the Articles of Confederation in the United States. Total collapse. By the way, our Constitution is totally illegal. Do you know that? Do you know why it's illegal? It didn't fulfill the requirements under the Articles of Confederation. It was a usurpation. These guys just scrapped this thing without any legal authority and said, we're going to start over again. We blew it, fellas. But they had no legal authority for that. They would have to go and had every state agree under the Articles of Confederation to an amendment. And they didn't do that. They had a 9 out of 13 agree to make it in force, which was in violation of the law then. In effect, either way, it won't make any difference now, right? Now, watch what happens. When you have economic chaos, when you have the blood in the streets, when you have financial collapse, you have a condition in which the man on a white horse rides in, and if he looks like he can solve this problem, if he is the devil himself, the people will rally to him. As Napoleon says, the crown was in the gutter, I merely picked it up. He picked up the crown and with a whiff of grape shot, he brought a semblance of order in the chaos, protected the parliament long enough to walk in and to seize power. He was a captain. 23 years old. Young kid. He took the show. With a whiff of grape shot, what did he do? What did he do to gain power and to seize and hold power? He declared that France from henceforth pays all bills in gold and will receive in gold. All foreign commerce will be paid for all imports in gold and all exports will be paid for in gold. You know what happened? France came from economic collapse to a runaway boom in prosperity in a matter of months. The French people worshipped Napoleon. Why? He brought them out of starvation to prosperity. Everybody had gold coins. He took away the outlawing of gold. He gave them gold, paid in gold. And what happened? England was now in financial trouble because England was running on the funny money game. And France started having hard money. And England fought for the next 20 years to destroy hard money. Until they put that guy down at Waterloo. Who dared give people an honest money. You know what brought Adolf Hitler to power? Runaway inflation. Hitler promised the hard money. Gold.
And the people had remember had been in a depression 10 years before we got there. They were ready for anybody. Anybody who could get them Wiener schnitzels and sauerkraut on that table. And they looked around at all the pansies and they said, the one thing about this Hitler, he's a tough guy, he's going to do it. And he shot a few people, he ran a few by the end of the ground one day, you know, and he had a night of extermination, and they all said, well, he had to do it. Had to do it. We're in trouble. And only a strong man can do it. And I'm going to tell you what's going to happen in this country. We're ready for an economic collapse. There's panic now in the streets. There's civil unrest. There's disobedience. Nothing on the horizon that looks like it's going to relieve this situation. There may be a temporary little relief, but the basic problem of massive doses of money to solve social problems is not going to be reversed in the foreseeable future. And what this means is that in every time every nation is turned to paper money, and paper money is the solution to their problems, have ended up in economic collapse. And every time you've had a collapse of the monetary system, you have had a total alteration of the government. There will be a coup d'etat. There will be a junta. There will be a new regime. That regime will survive if it can solve that problem with the most powerful and iron, ruthless means. And if it fails to do so, it will be replaced with a tougher junta that will. The problem is this, that your liberties and mine under that Constitution of the United States will not survive monetary collapse. The people will demand the monetary solutions at the cost of their liberties. And this is exactly what the establishment wants. They stand ready with that man on the white horse, and they're willing to deliver him to you. But just like the Rockefellers were financing Adolf Hitler from 1913, the Nazi movement, 1919 Hitler to the Reichsbank, 50% owned by the Rockefellers, was financing the Nazi party. And just as the Rockefellers finally supplied him with all the oil and gasoline until 1943 out of the Maracaibo oil fields, the same thing is this, that whoever there is going to come is going to be their puppet. And he is going to wield that iron hand, the iron hand in which he is the male fist. Here's the iron glove, but there will be another hand inside. A hand, a secret hand. Now you say that's pretty gloomy. That's the way most of the world has always been. Political liberty, constitutional freedoms, is a very rare thing in the history of the world. Very few people, nations have ever had it for a minute. And none of them have had it for long. We have had the enjoyment of a regional political liberty for a short span of time. More so than anyone else, maybe outside of the early Roman Republic. And solve most of our monetary problems. That's nice and simple. The next thing I would do is print the new money, only I would change the ink a little bit. And it would say United States Treasury instead of Federal Reserve notes. And we tell the Federal Reserve that they have to redeem all of their notes in Treasury notes. This would mean that the Federal Reserve would have to bring the bonds back, cash them in U.S. Treasury notes in order to pay off the people who bring in their Federal Reserve notes. This would now reduce the debt of the United States by the total amount of outstanding currency. Hey, that would cut the interest with a nice big hunk right there, wouldn't it? And cost nothing, since we got to continue to replace the currency all the time anyway. We just put a new picture on it. And you don't even have to back it at this time. You can still run confetti. But U.S. confetti, no interest on it. That would be simple, except you'd be shot. It's the biggest game going of the boys. The funny money game. All right, now what we do the next one? We'll say that no government... that we would cancel all sorts of giveaway programs and put it into one program called the General Dole. That is, cancel Social Security, cancel unemployment compensation, cancel ADC, cancel chicken pox relief fund, all the every one of the 10,000. You realize that in 1930 the U.S. code was this big. Today the U.S. code, these are just the laws that are governing you and me, run twice this. That's just the statutes which are governing you, the U.S. code. This isn't all the regulations now that fill rooms beyond it. That's just the core statutes. Do you realize the giveaway program was a small pamphlet of about 18 pages? Today, just the giveaway thing fills three full volumes of all the giveaway programs that have been passed, and they are now coming out with a new book like this every year of the new giveaway programs. And each one of those little pages are millions on everything from a study in how many toes can be cut off a monkey before he falls in his face. They had one for $500,000 to make a study on how many matches are left in the matchbook and the average matchbook when it is thrown away. They paid $500,000 for that study. Do you know that? They have those studies all. How do you think they fire against every riot group in the country? They put these riot leaders on government research grants. Find out how many broken telephones are out of order, pay phones, in the city of Detroit in the month of June. They'll pay $300,000 for that study. And this guy goes around, yeah, riot leader, and he goes and pays. There's 25 phones. And they give him $300,000, and there they go off and get have a lot more and support their organization. All of them are on the dole. Everyone's on the tape. Now you do another thing. Now that you got everybody on the general dole, then you say this. This way they couldn't be on 10 at once. You only got one. Everybody who's on the dole, you will come down to this compound and check in every day for 8 hours and sit on the bench. That way you can only go through the line once. At least you wouldn't have most of these welfare people in Detroit. They got 4 and 5 names they're filing under. They spend all day figuring out how to do that. That girl in there in the welfare office, she's got about 3 or 4 minutes to handle this guy. They sit there all day. How'd you do that? Well, now I got this woman. I did this, you see, and I've got this thing too. And they got that thing all down. Cool, man, cool. They run those things through. Now, you have them all sitting all day long on a bench. You know what about 80% of them say? I'm not sitting in here no more. I ain't your money. And they'll walk right out that gate, and you'll wipe out 80% of all the relief and poverty programs right there. Gone. They'll head right out that gate. Then the ones that are left. You see, we got this little project out here we'd like you all to do. We take them out, and we put them on a little work project, 8 hours a day. That'll reduce half of those. You know what happens? You can get rid of half the property tax now. Without cutting any of the essential services of police and fire protection and the courts and this, we'll wipe out that little game. You know what happens now when you cut those taxes like that? You see, the people, one, got money. Two, the interest rates fall. Three, sales go up. Four, unemployment falls down. Five, people want to run their business more because they can take more of it home. Today, the average guy says, it isn't worth the candle. I'm making enough. I'm not going to do anymore. I'm not going to sit here and work for the government anymore. I'm tired. I give up. The American businessman has had it. And he is just saying, so long. It's been nice knowing. The system is falling apart because the people are revolting. They're revolting because they've had enough. And these people aren't necessarily criminals. They don't mean, they want to work, they would like to produce. They would like to be good citizens, but the government has not given them the opportunity. Now, either they're going to quit this game or the system's going under. Now, they're scared now. They're partially scared. They're trying with Reagan to give you a little faith, something. They give you a little token, just a scrap or two off the table. They think that they can make you believe in the system again. Well, you won't. You know why? your taxes will be higher next year. That's why you won't believe in it. You'll say, oh, it was nice and wonderful. Except they took more. I had this tax cut, but it cost me more. Why? They had the inflation to put you in a higher bracket. So all the tax cut meant nothing because you got shoved in a higher bracket. They even admitted that the tax cut would not reduce anybody's taxes. Isn't that interesting? A tax cut doesn't reduce anybody's taxes. Because they're moving you by inflation into a higher bracket so they can give you a tax cut to keep your taxes about the same what they are now. But you didn't. Remember, you had a tax cut because you didn't get the normal increase you would get by inflation. You talk about monkey thinking. The only government can think that's stupid and survive because they force the revenues. Any businessman who thought like that isn't a businessman long. He's on the street. That's all true. That's all they did. They have washed up. Well, anyway, I've gone long enough. And if you haven't gone long enough, you can sit here and talk to each other. Thank you very much for your kind attention. And we could go on all night, and we probably wouldn't say much more than we said already. So thank you, and good night.
The tape you've just heard is one of many available from Emissary Publications. Call or write for a new catalog of books and tapes. These cover such topics as the New World Order, secret societies, masonry, conspiracies, world revolution, politics, finance, and history. Write Emissary Publications, 9010, that's 9010, Southeast St. Helens, Clackamas, I'll spell that for you, C-L-A-C-K, A, M as in Mary, A-S, Clackamas, Oregon, 97015. Or, if you prefer, you may call us at area code 503-824-2050. Thanks. We look forward to hearing from you.